Step right up, step right up, ladies and gentlemen. Portal Gaming Podcast, episode number 179 is coming at you. Howdy, everybody. Portal Game Podcast, a podcast of a store called The Portal, which is located in Manchester, Connecticut. For more information, you can go to www.theportalct.com. You can check us out on Facebook, The Portal, on Twitter, at Portal Gaming 60, and on YouTube. You can subscribe to our YouTube channel, Step Into The Portal, where we're doing unboxings and live playthroughs of games all the time. That is where you will find me. Portal Game Podcast is also a proud member of the Dice Tower Network. So for more amazing podcasts, you can go to www.dicetowernetwork.com. Here we are. Howdy, everybody. I am your host for this episode, The Brant. I am happy and excited to be here with you for episode 179. And I have a guest per usual. And my guest this time is Mason. Hello, Mason. How are you?
Hello. What's it been? 17 years now, I think, since I've been on.
Yeah,
I've lost track with COVID. So.
It's been a while. So Mason is a gamer in our store community and runs our local group for board gaming kind of in the Connecticut area, and is just a friend who's been on. I think this is your third time on the podcast, might be four.
Yeah, that's exactly where I fell. It's either three or four.
Yeah. But I always enjoy having you on because you just have such eclectic taste in games and just such insight. So it's always kind of educational for me whenever I get a chance to just sit and talk games with you, even playing games. A while back, like a year ago, we played that Schrodinger's cat game,
yes.
The trick-taking game. That was just so different from how I ever would have thought of a trick-taking game, but it worked.
Yeah, that was after my tastes have become even more eclectic. I'm now known as like trick-taking guy, trains guy, and maybe three other games. So
there you go.
I've certainly gotten to a weird spot with my taste. So although I haven't let my games that I want to talk about reflect it too much, definitely have a few that people should like on here.
Awesome. Well, you said you had five games. I've got three games, so I feel like we should just jump into talking about games because that's the fun of the podcast to me. So
sounds great.
Take it away.
So first game I'm going to talk about, and I'm not going to describe how it plays because I believe you've already taken care of that. That's Ark Nova. I mostly put this on here because it's extraordinarily good, probably a good argument for being my game of the year 2021, somehow beating out all of the games that more typically fit my tastes. It's a lot more heads down than I normally like, but it's just a phenomenal version of that. What I do think I like about it is how well it does compare to Terraforming Mars while also still leaving room on my shelf to own both. I think Terraforming Mars does a terrific job of being a combo building engine game where I care about the cards, and Ark Nova is a Euro that almost has that deck of cards stapled to it, where the cards act as a resource. They're something you have to consider, there's something you have to mitigate, there's something you have to play with, but they're certainly not the whole game. And if you go a heavy animal strategy, you're really not playing an engine game. You're playing a Euro game. You're playing an efficiency game. You're trying to maximize space. You're trying to maximize points. You're trying to maximize bonuses. But if you don't get those sponsors, which you don't have to do and can still win, then you're not playing that traditional Terraforming Mars experience in my experience. But that's been kind of my take on it, and that's why I've been enjoying it so much, because it's somehow both very familiar with that whole Terraforming Mars connection while also being an incredible breath of fresh air.
Yeah, I don't know what to say. It jumped to my number one. I made my whole top 10 for Dice Tower Winter Spectacular, posted the video, went through all that, and then I just was like, nope, to heck with all 10 of them. This is the best game I played all year. And I think I got it in on like December 28th or something when I finally got to play a copy of it. It was just so good. And I think it's already in my top 10 games and whatnot. It's just, it's great. And I think it's definitely comparable to Terraforming Mars. I don't mind that. But I think it's like, just don't forget the Rajas of the Ganges engine, and don't forget the Civ A New Dawn card action, which I think that card action is really what makes it so smooth. It's just like, what action do I want to do? And then I can even upgrade those actions. So it's just like another way. It's got so many routes, and it makes you pivot. And it reminds me so much of Through the Ages, really, in that sense.
What I love about that card engine so much is not that, I mean, it feels really good whenever you hit a rhythm and you're like, I'm going to do this at five strength. I'm going to do this at five strength. I'm going to do this at five strength. But where it really comes alive for me is with the opposite of that, where you feel very smart whenever you know when you have to do something at like two strength.
Right.
That's whenever I feel like a genius, not whenever I've gotten all this like five strength, like constantly pumping out the big actions, because you can just easily do the rightmost action all the time. It's whenever I realize when to break that, volley, that I feel so smart. And I think that game offers a lot of opportunities to break that volley and be clever in that way. So yeah, just every time I play it, I still find more and more to like about it. And I ended up getting this for Ben's birthday, but I tell him it felt like I was able to just get a birthday present for myself at the same time, because it was so, it's that good. Like, it's something I absolutely like. Terraforming Mars is one of his top three games of all time. So like, it was a no brainer to get that for him for his birthday. But like, at the same time, I'm just like, I still get to play it. So I definitely felt like I got lucky with that a little bit.
Yeah. I always think of Ben as being a Wingspan player. So I was intrigued by the bump up there, but it makes sense. Wingspan, Terraforming Mars, Ark Nova, that feels like a progression's the wrong word, but just this, right. They're in that same mindset.
Yeah, he's interesting. I think the third or fourth game I ever taught him was Food Chain Magnate. So he hopped in head first.
Yeah.
I
think Ark Nova has more player interaction than people are going to give it credit. Certainly it's a lot of heads down, but like, there's that tension of timing. When is somebody going to take the bonus? When is somebody going to make me discard my end game card? When is somebody going to end the game? Who's going to take cards? Playing cards that trigger off of, like, people were saying, oh, I don't think I ever would play it at four. And I was like, well, four, it's really interesting, because if I play the card where I get money every time somebody plays a primate, that's going to happen a bunch.
Mm-hmm.
Or if I play a card that says I get something for every Australian tag in play, that's going to be a lot more lucrative card in four player than it's going to be in two player or solo play. So, you know, it's not the greatest. It's Euro interaction, but it's not, we could completely be playing in booths separate from each other and then just see what our scores are, you know?
For me, though, I think that I still give Terraforming Mars a much larger nod for interaction, and not because of the take that. I think the take that is mostly there as a subtle balance to the plant strategy, which can get a little strong if you're not whapping it a lot. For me, I think Terraforming Mars wins out on those three tracks that are so player driven, because I feel like if you have penguins in your starting hand, or like penguins in your starting hand are in the first draft, you have to be really cognizant of, are those eight oceans going to get played out, or is this just going to be a dud for me, and that kind of thing.
Right.
So that's kind of where I see the difference. And I haven't gotten that in Ark Nova, but I just don't care. I'm almost happy that it's a heads down experience. I actually got a pretty bad headache on Friday, and it was so nice. Ben was pulling out Ark Nova, and I'm like, I can just play this. I don't need to worry about the other people at the table. I can wait for my headache to wear off. I'll have a little caffeine in case it's a caffeine headache. And I just played a very peaceful game of Ark Nova, and it was a great time.
Nice. Well, speaking of a heads down game, I'm gonna review Final Girl from Van Ryder Games, and this is as heads down as it becomes, because this is a solo only game. I believe there's a season two up on Kickstarter for this game, and I think it's now like the highest grossing Kickstarter solo game or whatever. So this is thematically just playing through all those 70s, 80s, 90s horror films. And I am not a horror fan film, but this game intrigued me. I got a chance to play a little bit of this, and I really wanted to play a whole bunch more. So I streamed a game on the channel, Step Into the Portal. You can see a playthrough there. And it's interesting. It's got a board. I guess it's played off of Hostage Negotiator, which is a whole, like, you have a set of cards and you can play the cards. Any cards you don't play, you get to hold over. Any cards you do play get set aside for one turn. And then any extra time you have in the turn, you can purchase new cards to go in your hand. But where it's really clever is the six cards you start with are free. So you play them, they sit aside for a turn, and then they all come back to you. And so you're trying to play all these cards to move around the board and rescue what are they called? Survivors is the only term I can think of. Like, you're trying to get survivors and get them to the exits, and then you can like power up your final girl and you're trying to defeat the whoever the big bad is, the horror monster. And it's neat. It comes like each one comes with two final girls and one monster. And then each monster has like a location. So this one that I'm holding up here has Maple Lane and Dr. Fright, which is definitely like a Freddy Krueger style thing and a Nightmare on Elm Street. And the location will have something, and the final girl will have something that goes with them, and the monster will have something that goes with them. And you can interchange them however you want. So you can create different interactions by doing that. The one part that's tricky is that you then roll dice to see what happens. So if you want to like sneak, you have to roll dice to see how successful you were at sneaking. And the dice have the Elder Scroll. No, what is it called? I can't think of that game. Arkham Horror. But there's the other one where you have to roll a 5 or a 6 for a success.
Yeah, that's Eldritch Horror too.
Eldritch Horror. Thank you. That was the game I was trying to find. I couldn't get there from Arkham Horror and Elder Sign. And it's a little harsh to have to roll a 5 or a 6 for a success. It does have a thing where you can discard 2 cards to get a success. So it's like they tried to put mitigation in, but there's just not quite enough mitigation for a bad die roll. There's no, like, if you totally fail, often you get a worse punishment than, like, you become determined, which is kind of what they do in Korra Quest or something like that, which would be nice.
Yeah, the discarding 2 cards only works if you roll a 4.
Yeah, right.
So that was what was frustrating for me. If you just like roll 2 dice and get 2 ones, you do. You don't have any mitigation there.
Yeah. So it in the end it becomes hard, is what happens, and hard could be related to random. I didn't really replay a lot of them. I admit I was more excited to try another one. And so I think I've won once out of 6 plays. I still enjoy it. I still enjoy it. It feels like I'm getting into the theme, even though it's not like I don't sit around and watch horror movies. I don't do horror movie month. I'm not really against them. It's just not my thing. But I feel like I'm having fun. So it kind of reminds me of like a Space Hulk Death Angel card game or a Ghost Stories where it's like, this is hard, but I'm having fun losing. But definitely from the just like straight strategy, like I'm going to figure out what to do with my brain, it's not quite there. So you have to let a little bit of that go and enjoy the interactions for it. So ultimately, I don't think it's something that will be played for me beyond this year. Like I think I'm just kind of having fun while I have it, but I don't see it having a long term for me.
It was, yeah, I'll go a little further down on it. It was a one and done for me, basically. I played it wrong once, and then I played it mostly right a second time, and I was fairly hooked on it. My biggest complaint, and I know so many people like it, so I do mitigate this a little bit with that caveat, is that it felt like I was playing basically Pandemic, except I had to roll dice to determine if I even got to do the action. That just felt incredibly frustrating to me. I also only like 5 to 10 co-op games total. So I'm not necessarily the target audience for this. I'm very, very picky on that genre. But it left me very cold. I will say that I don't like horror movies at all, and it got me into the theme too. Van Ryder, I know Shut Up Sit Down basically called them masters of this, and I don't think I can disagree at this point. They're really, really good at that kind of like turning a schlocky movie idea into a game. They did that brilliantly with Detective, which is one of my favorite games. And I don't think they did. I think they did a pretty good job here. If that's something you're into and you prefer your co-ops, or not co-ops, I guess, solo games on the Eldritch Horror side of things as opposed to the Pandemic side of things, this might not be the worst thing to try.
I think that might be me for solo gaming. So solo gaming is not my favorite thing. Sometimes it's a little bit forced. Generally, I prefer to just learn a game by playing two-handed. Or 2 players or whatever it would be. But I find that beat my score isn't my favorite compared to like do something. Like, you have a goal and go for that goal. And if I lose the goal, well, I lost the goal. But I don't know. Whereas, like, if I play a cooperative game with people, I kind of want that strategy element and that discussion and that cooperation. But when I play by myself, I don't mind if it's just the story that I lose. Mm-hmm. So there's that piece.
That
what do you
sense.
Got next?
Next, I'm going to go really far into the realm of the weird. This is called Starry Sky Trick-Taking. I have a friend who's been helping me do a lot of importing of trick-taking games from Japan. That's part, I got that cat in the box from BGG, but this is a direct import, doing a forwarder and all the nonsense that you have to do to get these games. And then he shipped them out all to his friends across the country. So it was, I think this game has been shipped 3 or 4 times total before it got to me. The way that this works is you have a blackboard. The blackboard is divided up into quadrants so that you can evenly space out these magnetic stars. The stars are numbered 1 through 12, and the cards in this game are numbered 1 through 12. And whenever you play, it's a 3-player only game. Whenever you play a card, everyone follows suit if they can, and then you draw lines based off of what numbers were put in the trick and what colors were put in the trick, and you draw them onto this blackboard. Okay. You're going to end up, I'm not going to get into exactly how they're drawn, but you're going to end up by the end of this with a certain number of lines drawn of 2 different colors and a certain number of intersections. At the bottom of each card is a quote unquote bid from either 7 to 13 of how many lines you're predicting are going to be on the board, lines plus intersections. So if you have 7 lines, 2 intersections, the correct bid would have been 9. The yep. card that you have left over is your bid. Whoever's closest just wins the whole game. So you're looking at this board. So you're spending this whole time looking at this board, seeing like what lines you're going to cause to get drawn. At first, it's very hard to feel out. You don't really know what you're doing. Almost kind of like cat in the box. You don't know where the hand's going. And then once you get down to 2 or 3 cards, you have a much better picture of how this is looking. And then it starts to get really, really tense right at the end. And you're just like, how do I get exactly the right number of lines drawn? Because I want to make my bid. I compared this one to Six Nymph in the sense that whenever people play it, they're going to think that it's really random. And then they're going to 2 games later insist there's a ton of strategy. And then 50 games later, they're going to go back to saying it's random. And it's just going to oscillate like a sine wave.
How many people do you know besides you who have played it 50 times?
Oh, not I've not played this 50 times.
Okay, gotcha.
I played 6 and probably 50 or more
no,
times.
No, I totally get it. I'm just thinking, I'm just laughing at like at that. I totally get what you're saying. I see what you're saying, but it was just a great way of wording it.
My estimate is that probably somewhere between 10 and 20 people in the entire United States have played this game.
Right.
And I know probably 19 of them.
What was the name of it again?
Starry Sky Trick-Taking. I feel a little bad because this is not a game you're realistically going to be able to get. But if you do ever have a chance to see me, I'm going to try and keep this in my car most of the time. And if you want to get a game of this just to see what the heck this thing is, feel free to track me down because I absolutely love teaching this game. It is a wild ride, whether or not it's good or not. Whether or not it's actually good, I think doesn't matter. But I also do think the game is actually pretty good, which was a nice surprise. I don't buy these games expecting them to always be good.
Yeah, I mean, trick-taking games, there's something about them. There's something whatever cultures, you know, it's prominent in, which seems to be a lot. There's just something about people will play a trick-taking game. I think it's why The Crew took off. They're just people that grow up playing trick-taking games. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so it just feels natural to move over to one that's just in a box. So you never know. Like, you're talking about it now, but if enough people pick it up, all of a sudden thousands of people want it. It gets printed here. You know what I mean? That's how it starts, with just word of mouth. So
yeah,
it's always interesting to hear about games like that.
Nice. Yeah, that I actually will note that Eric Summer sometimes stops in the store, and I know you've had him on the podcast. I actually secretly try to see if I can get him to play a game or two out of my really weird box. Because if he mentions it on the podcast, I think the chances that it gets reprinted go up 5%.
That's a good call.
So what's your next one?
All right. Well, mine is pretty short and sweet here. This is Three Sisters. So I got my full Kickstarter copy in. You can actually go back and see we did a video. Kathy and I did a video on the day they launched the Kickstarter, which must be over a year ago now, or actually probably around a year because this one was pretty fast to deliver. But this is from the Fleeples, Ben Pinchback and Matt Riddle, and their new company Motor City Games and 25th Century is helping them distribute it. And it is the follow-up to Fleet the Dice Game. So that's what it comes down to. Most people that know me know that Fleet the Dice Game is one of my favorite games. I absolutely adore it. It's my favorite roll and write game. I just love – I mean, it's essentially a Euro game on a pad. Like, it doesn't really fall into the other category. But so people can see a playthrough of it. Kathy and I play tested this game. So, you know, we're all in on it. So obviously I'm going to really enjoy the game. Where it compares to Fleet is it is definitely shorter than Fleet the Dice Game. It's a little more entry level than Fleet the Dice Game. It's a little bit more straightforward what you're doing. It's a little more thematic because the three sisters are corns, beans, and squash. Squash is represented by pumpkins, and there's a whole system for that. So you have to like grow the corn, and then when the corn gets to a certain height, you can start growing beans. And then around the garden, you're putting squash, which are the pumpkins. And as you connect things, you get all these bonuses. And then you can work in your garage. You can go pick fruit. And you can also work on your apiary, which is your beehive area. And you can get all these bonuses. And every game, you can go a different direction. The one part that's missing to me that I love about Fleet is you don't, like, roll and start with some ability at the beginning of the game. But that does make it a little bit more accessible that everybody's just kind of on an even playing field. And it just plays shorter. The draft is easier. And the key part that they kept, which I'm so happy because I gave them the feedback on the original version, is that once everybody drafts a die, originally that was it. It was over. And they went back and said, okay, everybody gets an additional action afterward. And that's the best part of it. That's just my favorite dice drafting. Drafting of any kind is, you know, you roll a certain number, you leave a couple extra there, everybody gets one, and then everybody gets one of the leftovers. Which just makes the drafting just a little more interesting and a little more exciting. It feels like you're getting a free thing. Like, here's a free thing. You didn't even have to pick it. And they added that back in. So check it out. Check out Three Sisters. It's coming out. It'll come into distribution or into retail soon. And it's just a great, great roll and write game. Nice and thematic. And it plays probably in about 2/3 of the time of Fleet the Dice Game. So a lot more accessible.
Haven't gotten a chance to play this one. I've played Fleet the Dice Game, and Andrew, local to us, mentioned something that had me a lot more interested in this one. He said that it seems to have more branching of like different paths you can go down. And I know that for me, Fleet the Dice Game definitely felt like it had a little bit of an issue where I have done most of the game by the time it ends. Does this feel like you end with less of the paper filled out?
Because I think for sure
that's awesome.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah, there's a shot that you'll just like never do the apiary. I would say, like, typically you're always going to do the garden. The garden is one of the sheets, so you're always going to do that. But then you're going to pick, like, are you really doing fruit trees? Are you really working in your shed? Are you gaining goods? Are you doing the apiary? Are you doing the perennials? And you're not going to do all of those areas to the max.
Yeah.
I agree with you in Fleet what you're saying, but it's typically, to me, it's really how deep you go into a type of fish. So I've not done games where, like, I go deep into all the fish and really up the abilities of those. But there's definitely some, having played the game, I don't know, probably 50 times, that seem better for getting high scores.
Yeah, that's fair.
But that's just what happens in any game. Once, like you were saying, once you play it 50 times, you unlock some of those strategies that it was hard for them to get in playtesting, right?
Yeah.
Cool. That is Three Sisters.
All right. So next for me is a big one, old one, and a terrific one, War of the Ring. I have I've gotten a chance to play this about 3 times in the past 2 weeks.
Okay.
And it's just one of those games that is so much better when you get to play it back to back and see the different strategies and how they go. I actually got to play the first edition, so technically I do get to cross that off on my BGG top 100.
because it still on the top 100 in first edition?
I think so. Maybe gotcha. 200. I might have dropped to 200. BGG top 100, silly sometimes. But it for the The first edition, definitely a few differences that caught me off guard because he had the expansion for the first edition and never saw the siege engines. Those aren't actually out in the second edition yet. So I had to relearn a few things, but it doesn't matter. Either edition's phenomenal. I got to play with his painted set, that rare collector's edition that costs $1 million now. It's just great. They do the pandemic thing where almost every game comes down to the wire. I don't know how they get that done. It feels like literal magic. Usually by the time the ring bearer's on the foot of the crack of doom, you have about eight out of the 10 victory points you need. And then it's just a matter, do you get that last stronghold or do they throw the ring? And every time it's, I don't know why the same ending every single time gets me as excited as it does, but it's still, it's like riding a roller coaster five times. Like, I'm not going to get sick of it. It's still a thrill. All of the cards are done perfectly. I almost wish, more war games, Twilight Struggle kind of does this. I almost wish more like historical war games would take the tact as well as this game has, because it feels like it gets you all of the beats that you're expecting from the history of War of the Ring, but you're not getting them in the same order. You're not getting them in the same, you're not getting them at the exact same time. They're responding to different things and whatnot. Like, you might have I had Legolas break off really early and go to Bree. That never happened in the movie, but like he activated the North all the way up to at war status right away. Like, just the one thing that did happen in the movies in my last game, I had the Ents kill Saruman.
Oh, there you go.
And that's just right out of the movies. And yet, it's like these scenes that they just copy right out of the movies. They're just copying them into the game, and it still feels exciting. If you ever have a chance to play this, it's not nearly as big and complicated as people are going to make it sound. If you've played your Boon Lakes, if you've played your Ark Novas, you can play your War of the Ring, and you'll have a terrific time with it. So
yeah, it's one of those ones there. It's just length and decisions that make it, you know, feel like it's this big game, and it's just telling an epic tale, right?
Yeah.
But like, in terms of mechanisms, it's not hard. It's just read the card and roll some dice and trigger the abilities, and then you're just making the choice. Like, do I want to move first, or do I want to first play this card and get this card in play? And what am I going to do and react to the other player? And it's really just comes down to that is where the part of it is.
I have an idea on how we could sell this to the audience. It is a dice drafting game designed by two Italian designers.
There you go.
it's honestly, when it comes down to it, it's basically Grand Austria Hotel. So right. You're drafting, you roll those dice, you draft them for actions. You might as well bust it out. It's the next Gollum. It's the next T-game.
It is
a T-game. It's the War of the Ring. All right.
I don't have much to say other than what you said. I mean, I would just say that, like, it's not one of my top games because it's just not typical that I get to play it very often. But it was about, I'm going to say 3 years ago, it might have been four, and somebody was, like, at my house. They're like, I want to play that game. I'm going to come over on a Saturday and bring a four or six pack of beer, and will you teach me that game? And they had played party games with me only. And we sat for 4 hours, and we played that game. And we had a blast, and it was completely like entry level for that person just because they were interested in the theme and they were interested in sitting there for 4 hours. And it was a great game.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think I've played it since then.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's awesome. It's up there for a reason. It'll stick around for a reason. All right. Last up for me, and then you can do your last two, is a new game from Elf Creek Games. This is Merchants of the Dark Road. Elf Creek Games has made like Atlantis Rising and Honey Buzz and some others. They're doing the new Santa's Workshop, which I'm really excited for. They're going to make that one a lot bigger. This is Brian Sewer, and Merchants of the Dark Road is... You have like a wagon that goes around a pentagonal rondelle. So there's five stops. And then the other half of the board is this dark road with all these locations you can go to. And you're essentially the merchant going around, and you're trying to, you've got your wagon and you're upgrading your wagon. You've got a horse that is specific to you and has a power, and you have spaces and You can go around and you've got like slight economics in that you can like purchase items that will equip on heroes. And then like there's like a little mini wheel that spins around and changes the values of those. But I wouldn't really say it's like an economic game. That's just part of it. And then you can go to the tavern and you can hire the heroes, which essentially is actually the reverse. They almost hire you. You equip them with their items. They join your wagon. And then eventually you can go to a location where you can travel the dark road and anybody can go with you if they want to. So all the players choose and you kind of flip a card, and it's a really interesting action because most of the actions are very standard, like go to this place and do this one, maybe two things. But the dark road is like the backside of the player card tells you the 12 things that you have to do. So it's a little overwhelming at first, and you're like, why would I go there? And what am I doing? And people are coming with me, and you drop stuff off. But essentially what you're trying to do is get prestige by doing that, by bringing items. There's like requests, or they're not really quests, but they're like requests to drop off items to the towns, as well as these heroes. And based on what you complete, you get either prestige or you get coins. And my favorite part of the game that's really, really good is at the end of the game, you check the prestige track versus your coins, and the lower is your score. And then you may add a few victory points that come out through a deck, but it's very few. Like there's maybe 6 to 10 victory points in the deck in addition. So it's not like you get your end score and then you quadruple it with victory points. It really is focused around that balance. Which is interesting because if it was just one or the other, you could kind of just run the efficiency engine around the rondelle. But without that, you have to like think about how to balance those two and like, ooh, now I'm really good at doing this and I did it a bunch. And now I need to figure out how I'm going to bring the other back. So we played this at PAX, and this is one of Kathy's favorite games. We played at PAX, and I was kind of like, it was okay. I didn't really understand it. I thought the dark road, there were a couple mechanisms. But we played it recently the other day when we had a snow day or something, and it was great. The two-player, I really enjoyed it way more than my first play, but it was long. Now, I'm not talking long. It was like 90 minutes altogether. We kind of broke it up into three sessions with having to shovel and go outside with the kids and everything. But like, it felt like a long 90 minutes to 2 hours for a two-player game. So I'm intrigued where that would go. We had played for the first time with three, and I don't think it took us more than 90 minutes at all. But sometimes when you're at a convention, you don't realize that it took you 2 hours to do something versus when you're at your house. So I am now intrigued to play this game again. After my initial play, I was like, no, but I'm glad that Kathy really likes it. But after my second play, I'm back in. I am enjoying this game. And the production is absolutely through the roof, which is a big part of Elk Creek Games.
Yeah, I'm definitely excited to try this one. I'm hoping that I think it's at the shop in the so I'm planning on learning it at some point once I make it through a few other games.
But I will be back at the shop. You can see it in my hands here.
Okay, that is the shop's copy. Fair enough.
Yeah, I took it home to play during the snowstorm.
But I've been very excited because it's one, it looks very evocative and more thematic than your typical Euro. I'm not sure how much that comes through. And then the other thing that you just mentioned, I actually really like low scoring games. Part of why I like Dune Imperium so much. I think that whenever you really make players work for the points, it changes how you have to think about the game. In a really good way. It can certainly put the focus on certain things, and you can't just get points from anywhere. So I do really appreciate that.
It's interesting. I'll be interested to see what people's reaction are. It just reminds me of Botoku is the other one that's just very in that, like Botoku looks gorgeous. And then there's this weird puzzle that I think some people are just going to enjoy and other people are going to be like, I don't know. That puzzle's kind of weird for me.
Yeah.
So interesting. We'll see. All right, you got two more for us.
Yes. So I'm going to start off with, I think at the beginning of the pandemic, it was becoming clear I was turning into the train game guy, and that has certainly continued. I think I found a recent love, and I wanted to give it a shout out because it is at the store, and I would like to see these games sell well for Brian's. Let me stock some more. And this one is 1848. I consider this to be probably in my top three 18XX games right now. Okay. I love it because it is based off of the 1830 system, which if you know 18XX, you'll know what that means. But basically, it's a very easy.
Is that like the original 18XX?
Yeah, no, it's the roughly? Second. It's the second 18XX, but it's okay. The one that popularized it in America, especially.
Yeah, like Mayfair? Did Mayfair have that one?
Or who Avalon Hill originally made it, and then Mayfair got a hold of it. They actually say that Avalon Hill turned it into a war game, and it basically did. If you've ever played 1830, it is meaner than most games you can imagine. It's about as mean as Diplomacy, give or take. Gotcha. So 1848 is based off of that system to an extent in the sense that you can learn the rules from it. But with the subtle change is it doesn't become as aggressive or mean. You can't really go into bankruptcy very easily. You'd have to try pretty hard to go bankrupt. You can get hurt pretty bad. But what I love about it is it has one big twist, which is the Bank of England, which is a near endless source of money, but you trade stock value for it. And that creates a really interesting thing because you can invest in the Bank of England. So if more companies are taking loans from it, you do better, you get more money. And if more companies fail, that also helps the Bank of England. So the Bank of England is almost like betting on the game state to blow up. And then if you're invested enough in it, you're sometimes incentivized to blow up the whole game, to just crash the economy, gotcha. Wreck a few companies. And It allows for a lot of different strategies, a lot of different levels of play, with probably the most simple rule set in 18XX, which is the 1830 rule set. Mm-hmm. So it's very easy to get into, probably more so than 1846, although 1846 is going to be the friendlier experience. And that's the other one I would recommend, and that's at the store as well. Yeah. But 1848 is just an absolutely fascinating game with not a lot of overhead. And if you are someone who has played Food Chain Magnate and enjoyed it, that you don't have a lot of an excuse not to hop into at least one 18XX game at some point. You'll probably have a very, very good time, and it might change your gaming life like it has for a lot of people who just play nothing but these. So I just wanted to give a shout out to that one because I don't think people consider those games enough. They view them almost like war games that are like, oh, they're chits and counters and too long and too difficult, and I'm just not going to bother with them. But I think there's a there's a class of player that really would be benefited from hopping in. And I will mention, we do also run an 18XX event once a month at the Portal, usually on Saturdays. Yep. If you follow the Game on Chits and Giggles Facebook page, you'll be able to find out more about that. So if these do sound interesting to you, I push these pretty hard because I think a lot of people would enjoy them.
What is the player count and what is the time length on 1848?
Some people will tell you it only plays at 4. Well, and the official player count, I believe, is either 3 to 6 or 2 to 6. If it is 2 to 6, I wouldn't touch it at 2. Yeah. Three is honestly seems fine to me, and 5 was fine, although it had a bit of a weird start. I personally would say 3 to 5, especially if you're starting out. Player count matters a lot less. A lot of these really hardcore 18XX players will get these ideas of player counts that you can only play this at 4 players or whatnot, because sure. They're so good at the game, they recognize the flaws and the cracks that happen at other player counts. But if you're new to the system, just play right. it. Yeah, yeah, that expands a little bit. Your beginner mistakes and like not recognizing something is going to do far more to make the game weird than anything player count wise would do. And that's also another thing I love about these games. These games, far more than any Euro or anything, can just go weird, and I love. Weird game states. I love whenever like the goofy stuff happens, and these really allow for that. I think I can move on to my last one unless you had anything more to ask about 1848.
No, go for it. We're ready.
Rolling right on to Ankh. I got that Kickstarter a little while back. Got to play it a handful of times, and I really, really like this one. It probably was a slam dunk for me, considering Rising Sun is a top 10-20 game depending on my mood, and this does a really good job with that. It actually almost uses the same action system that some of my Cube Rails games that I like use. It nice. it borrows a bit from Chicago Express, which every time you do an action,
right.
you move that marker down. And then once it gets down to the end, you trigger like a little bit of an upkeep phase. You trigger what is called an event in this game. You do something and you move on. And you trigger enough events by getting those markers down. You then go into battle. And there are only going to be 5 or 6 battles in the game, battle rounds in the game, and they're 1 battle per region whenever you do a battle round. And that's where you get, I think, the only way to get points, which is really interesting. You spend all this time setting up, you spend all this time maneuvering, and then you really need to be, you really need to be present and ready for those battles. It's just so different than Rising Sun. It's so different than any other game. It's almost like a multiplayer abstract because it's so focused. It puts such a singular focus on the maneuvering and the positioning, and every hex can only hold one figure, so it feels like an abstract in that way,
right.
like chess. Right. And I don't know what it is about this, but I just really, really enjoy it. It's, have you gotten a chance to play this? I know Brian.
No, but literally I started to set it up on my kitchen table. It's sitting down there and I read through most of the rule book.
Oh, excellent.
So I was actually going to ask you if you've played it at 2.
I have not. I really want to, and I actually have a friend who I might be pitching that to soon. I've been playing a handful of 2-player games with him at various meetups, I haven't gotten a chance to. But Z Garcia threw it in as like top 30 or whatever of all time, based off of only 2-player.
I have heard so times. Many good things about it at 2 that's why I grabbed a copy, opened it up, and I was like, I'll try this. And Kathy was like, she liked the look of the minis and everything. Like, she thought that would be fun to play, you know. We'll have to see. I don't know how interactive it'll become, or if it'll be non-interactive at 2 players, or if it'll be direct conflict. So
yeah.
I'm really intrigued to try it. Not that I don't want to play it at higher player counts or feel like it would be better, but sometimes I can just get a game played at 2 at my house, especially right now with COVID going on, you know?
Yeah. And also, since one more thing I just realized I wanted to mention, this won't come up in your 2-player game, but since it was the big controversy surrounding the game, I am pro-merge. The merge is fun. I am very pro-merge. I think that it creates a really interesting dynamic where you get to team up with someone. And like, honestly, I think people's biggest problem with the merge is because they didn't plan for it. And I know it sounds like I'm being a jerk and I'm saying just play better.
Sure.
But what I don't mean play better. I mean, consider the merge a real thing that is going to happen. Don't be in denial about it. And make sure you are in the position you want to be for the merge. If someone is lagging way at the bottom because the merged players get the lowest score of the two, fight to not be merged with them. But if everyone is really clumped up close together, you probably want to be a part of that merge and maybe hold back and maybe even, dare I say it, collude with the other players. This is a war game. Talk to them. Be
yeah.
like, oh, we might be really well positioned to merge. Your God's power works really
right,
well
so
with
let's
mine.
Back off.
Yeah, so let's back
and
off.
And then everybody's trying to back off.
Well, you play the card simultaneously, but there's nothing in the rules that says you can't tell the other player what you're going to play. Be like, all right, I'm going to play this. It's going to get me more points. If you play this, we'll maximize our points together because I know we're going to merge. We're both at the bottom. You got to be prepared for it. You got to know that it's happening and actually plan for it. And then I think you'll have a lot of fun with it because it creates this moment you're not getting from any other game. And I think that's really valuable in a game.
Yeah, to me, the place I can see that merge, so if people don't know, it's that the play, at a certain point in the game, the person who's in last place merges with the second to last place. The way I can see that is that if it's just a game day and you show up and people are like, we're playing Ankh, and it's your first play, it's a little bit of an unfriendly mechanism for a first. Like, okay, I know this is here and people might warn me, but it could just feel weird as opposed to like, do you want to play Ankh? Yeah, it's my fifth play. I can't wait. I'm going to work around that merge. You know what I mean? It just it has a little bit of that feel. It's kind of like the 18XX thing. Like 18XX does get better once you have a handful of them under your belt as opposed to those first plays where you're like, I did something and people knew what they were doing at the table, but not me. So I can see that merge making you feel like, well, I played so poorly that they just gave me a consolation prize. Like, why don't you just walk away? Which you don't, but you feel like that, right? Like, why don't you just give up? So I can see that on a first play for people being a tricky mechanism. Or it's certainly controversial, right? It's just like you're getting knocked out of a game. We don't really see that anymore either. So,
but I mean, there are a lot of experienced gamers who have come to me and said, I'm not even going to play my pledge now that I've learned about the merge mechanism. I'm going to sell. I've actually had a friend tell me that. And I'm like, what are you doing? Just try it. It's great. It's like you've played so many war games. You know, you know how to manipulate this. Just pop in. Water's fine. So
speaking of old mechanisms that we don't see around as much anymore and new games, you had a topic related to this that we'll jump right into.
Very much not in the line of Ankh. That is a very new game. Brant, do you think games are constantly getting better?
I think as a whole, yes.
Okay. So I am going to now take the other side of that. Okay. I tend to think that game designers are getting better, but my argument here is that game designers are getting better at selling games. They are getting better at knowing what gamers want and knowing how to do that, but they're not necessarily making a game to last 50 plays like they did back then. Now, this might sound like old man yells at cloud a little bit, my argument comes with a few contenders. Haunted Teutonica, I don't think is the type of game that would necessarily get made today. Agricola, Puerto Rico, El Grande. Now, do you think that I'm wondering, do you think that these type of games would, I'm trying to figure out how to phrase this. Do you think that these games had more people focusing on the development of them, working harder on them? Or do you think that do you think they just stood the test of time because 100 games were made back then and these were the ones that rose to the top?
Yeah, it's a good question. I could argue that either way. I do think those are good games because those are games that I would still play.
Yes.
So there's something to that for sure. I definitely think those games were well tested and well played for sure. So I don't think they just kind of made them and it was like, well, here's a game. We got an idea. Let's see if it works. And games aren't really popular. So I'm doing this as my side job because there was really like no full-time game designers except who maybe Avalon Hill hired, Milton Bradley hired, and a few in Germany, right? Like that might have been full-time game designers, but other than that, nobody was. I think those are good games. I think they were well tested. I think people knew that they would go over well.
Do you think modern games get that same level of development? Because I think a lot of modern games get really good development for that. You hear this a lot now for the first play. The first play needs to be good. The first play needs to grab you. But do you think they're ignoring the 50th play?
I think so. I think just games aren't necessarily made to be played 50 times anymore.
Okay.
I think it's just part of the hobby. I think that's kind of what people want. It's like, you know, like in movies now, you just see in 10 seconds, how many different camera angles do you see?
Yeah.
Right. Whereas if you go back to the 1950s, it was basically like they were filming a play.
Okay.
Right. Like, so it's just changed what people want. Now there's some things to me that seem better, like getting rid of roll and move. But that doesn't mean you can't put roll and move in and make a good game. It's just that can't be the main like mechanism of the game. It feels like that is a little bit tired. You know what I mean? So that kind of stuff feels gone. Balance is somewhat your focus on. There's no doubt production is better, right? So there's just no argument there. But of course, cost is up, and popularity's there. I also think games are made like there's a wider. I don't know if that games are made for a wider audience, but there's a wider audience to games now, which is interesting. Other than if you took out like the family games, the Milton Bradley family games that, you know, we kind of all grew up on that were, you know, either created wide appeal or were made for wide appeal. I don't know. But, you know, hobby games feel like they have a wider audience now for sure. I don't know. Maybe they're taking more risks. Certainly people are making more games. So, you know, getting that game that like, all right, here it is. And the 50th play of Three Sisters is going to be as exciting as the first game of three. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm going to see more things emerge. I don't think so. I think, like you said, there's more pathing in this game. And once you've done all the paths, that's the game.
Yeah.
And you're not. And so since there's not as much interaction, you're not seeing some of those things like you were mentioning related to 1848. Like, wow, there's just some things that I've never seen happen before come up in this game. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not going to see that in a lot of games you're not going to see that in as many games these days.
Yeah, I mean, 18XX fans will tell you that the amount of meticulous craftsmanship and work that goes into an 18XX game is off the charts. Like, because they're not looking to, no one is making money off. I mean, no one makes money off of board games necessarily, but no one is making money off of 18XXs. one designer who I think, I know he states that he still very much cares about this craft part of it is Tom Lehman, because he says he doesn't release a game until he thinks it can stand a 50 plays. And Race for the Galaxy to me is the shining example. I played that game, thanks to Board Game Arena, literally 200 times in 2 months.
Right.
That's one of those things, and I'm wondering, is there a bastion that players who miss these old Euros, these tested Euros, can go to, or do you think? Because I'm wondering, because how big the hobby gets, are there people who still care about the craft? I mean, I this is almost coming across like I'm disparaging designers.
Yeah, right.
And I don't mean to be doing that. I do think designers are very, very good. I do think, though, that the incentives are for that first play, and I don't think that that's anything to disparage them on, because they have. I mean, some of the just even listening to Ludology, just the discussion, the thoughts on the craft, all of the things they've learned and improved are there. I'll let you answer the question that I kind of interrupted myself on. Do you think there is a bastion for people who want these 50 play Euros or these 50 play games?
I do. I definitely think those games still exist. I think those designers still exist. I just think, to me, now that I thought about it a little bit more, I think as there's a wider appeal, as games are able to make more money with things like Kickstarter opening up, more retail space, games being more popular, people playing games, wanting to get away from screens, and there are more designers, you know, there just are more games coming out. I think part of that wider appeal is you just have a larger cross-section. Like, there are just people who, they love Wingspan, and they play Wingspan twice a year, but that's they're going to own it. They're excited about it. They don't need to play Wingspan twice a day to say, I love Wingspan, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's people like me who, like, I'm going to play a game three times and review it, and then I'm going to move on, and I'm going to come back to that top 2% and keep replaying them. But I'm not going to play, you know, all the games that many times, but I definitely think games exist that open up after you play them 5 and 10 times and still have new things at 50 plays. I think games that have been made in the last 3 years, I think Terraforming Mars is still that game. You still see unique things happen in Terraforming Mars as you play it out, you know? So I think those games definitely exist. You talk about Tom Lehman. I mean, that Res Arcana game, that just plays different every time.
Yeah.
It's got that same feel that you said for Race of the Galaxy. So I think it still exists. I think it's still there. I just think, like anything, there are people of different of different likes, of different tastes. So there are people who are like, hey, I want to hear about the game and I just want my first game to be fun and then I'm going to move on to the next game and I don't need 50 plays. And there are designers who are like, I'm not designing the game for 50 plays, and I think that's okay.
Yeah. And then the other, so craftsmanship and replayability were the two things that I was, because I was thinking, like, are there anything we've lost or whatnot? And I think in some ways you could argue that we have, in other ways we haven't, and designers are still, designers exist who are still making games with the craft, with the replayability. The other thing that I've wondered if it's gone down a little bit is old Euros, they talk about the interactivity and the meanness. You don't see that kind of interaction. Like Puerto Rico, you don't have that kind of classic that is just so interactive, that is so dependent on the player before you nowadays, unless I'm like that kind of simple but interactive. Oh, Grande is another great example, I think. Brass to another extent. We did get Brass Birmingham.
Yeah. No, I think they're there. Unfortunately, I can't come up with them off the top of my head right now.
Okay.
But I think they're still there. I think there's still games. I don't think they're classics. I don't think they're immediate classics. I don't think there's a game where you say like, oh, wow, look at this way Puerto Rico did it. And now this game does it. And everybody loves this game. But like, what was the other race for the, we're, look at Tom Lehman's just getting all the praise here. What, New Frontiers or something?
That
was like the board game version.
Was
of
he the
Race
one who
for
designed,
the Galaxy.
He's the one who designed. I don't remember if he was the one who designed.
Yeah, I think he did. And so, you know, that was still there. It's just that game didn't get nearly the appeal that Race for the Galaxy did, or even Roll for the Galaxy. But I think it's still there. I think games like that are still there for sure. There's so many more. Mm-hmm. And I think production is a big part. There's people who want production and there's people that just don't care about production. Like right? Like I always joke with Brian, but he'd be just as happy if it was slips of paper that said this is a mini that's 8 centimeters tall. Like he doesn't care. You just paint a little blue dot on it. Like it's not important to him. But I know for Kathy, like aesthetic is huge. Mm-hmm. So say, let me see the game, open it up, put the board out. No, I don't want to play that.
Yep.
Wait, no, this has a game, this has mechanisms you love. And she just, that aesthetic is important. So I think we have a wider audience of gamers, and that's kind of what we're seeing. But I think those games still exist. Unfortunately, I can't quickly recall any of them for you.
I know, and I've had a hard time too. The only one I'm coming to, I mean, that was like somewhat recent, is The Estates, but that's a reprint from 10 years ago.
Right.
It just didn't get. I actually think I'm going. I actually think I somewhat agree with you on the craftsmanship and replayability. But I think once you add in the interactivity and the meanness, I'm not sure we are getting those games as much. The El Grandes, the Hansa Teutonicas, the ones where, because I don't think I think whatever, for whatever reason, the tastes, the zeitgeist has moved away from these games where you really interact with the other players. And I will say that there's about two or three people who I think sort of are carrying that banner, but almost off to the side, the Splatter guys.
A great example.
Yeah, they've been making games fairly slowly, and I think they're now like about 4 years since their last release. But thankfully, they're coming out with something this year. I'm so excited for Horseless Carriage. I would say them. I would say Amabel at Hollandspiel. Mm-hmm. Makes some very interactive games, but she's in just about the weirdest corner of the internet. You're getting these games that feel like they're hand assembled. They're great. I love a lot of her games, especially Sue Line, but they're kind of off to the side. And then I would say another designer, Paul Worley, is probably the one. I mean, he really goes in hard on his development. He really goes in on his interactivity, and I think he's doing a good job. But yeah, definitely feel. I'm just wondering if we have if we've had something move and everything in it. And I don't want to say that I'm not trying to make the argument that games have gotten worse. I'm just trying to make the argument that I honestly think games have gotten better, like in almost every facet. But I do think that there's an argument to be had that things have shifted in one small way. And that's kind of those are probably like the four, I would say, like the four horsemen of the things that we've lost: craftsmanship, replayability, interactivity, and meanness.
I, not, I not, think not, that's not, just,
not all at once. I don't think we've lost all at once. I think I can point to mean games and interactive games, but I don't think, I think we've gotten a lot fewer of the and I keep saying this game, Haunted Photonicas.
Yeah, I think it's just like, I don't know if it's a, I don't know if a cultural shift is the right term, but just a mind shift in gamers. Like, I mean, look at cooperative gaming. Since all those games you named came out, cooperative gaming has been on a huge boom. And there were certainly cooperative games around when those games were, but like cooperative gaming is a boon. I mean, look at, there is a channel, there are multiple channels, but specifically One Stop Co-op Shop only does cooperative games, and they can make a top 20 every year, multiple episodes, fill every day with videos on a new cooperative game. So, I mean, that is just a huge part of gaming now. Nature games are selling. Now, you could argue that nature games could be like, all right, well, I'm the bear, and the bear comes in and eats all your piece. You know what I mean? It could be that for sure. But nature is a huge part of it. And just Euro games, really, just Euro games with low interactivity, the quote-unquote multiplayer solitaire, are just something that people really, really eat up. There's a big portion of the population of hobby gamers that just really enjoy non-interactive Euros, and I think I tend to be in that camp. Like, I prefer the low interaction to the high interaction for the most part, because I'm not good at reading other players, but I'm excellent at reading a board state, you know?
Yeah. And sometimes just having those, sometimes you can't, a lot of those require like a little bit of the gift of gab on like, hey, if you do this or that. And sometimes sometimes, as I mentioned a few weeks ago, I had a pretty bad headache. I just don't want to talk to other people. And if I can, build my little zoo and I can put my animals in it, and if I can release them and get my conservation points or whatnot without having to do anything more than say, it's your turn, I'm happy. I agree with you. I think that those games definitely have their place for that reason and many, many more. Nice. I just something to think about, because this whole topic is, honestly, I have a friend who, puts his middle name as Games Before 2017, because that is it. Because he holds that mantra up, every game is better if it's before 2017.
Yeah. And I definitely see what you're saying, but like you said, I wouldn't want to disparage designers. Like, they're designing games that people are loving, so do that. You know, if that's what people are loving, design games that people are loving, because that's the fun of the hobby, you know? And that's what I always say. There's always a game for somebody, but you got to find that right game. And then you got to play the games of that type. And sometimes you just have to decide, well, I'm here to play with people, so I'm going to play what the people are playing, you know, so I can have fun with that. It's the people more than the game, you know, often. So that's kind of what we're doing there.
Yeah, cool.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Mason, for joining us. Episode 179 of the podcast. It's always great to talk to you. You have such insight that I don't have. You think of topics that I don't think about. And I love it. Being an academic person, I love just having these conversations and hearing about games of this type, and just when people make me think different than what I thought. I love when you said, like, a roller coaster. Like, I'll just get on the roller coaster again and it will still be fun, even if it's my fifth time in a row. And that's a great way to think about some games. Like, nothing changed. The roller coaster is exactly the same, but the fifth ride was just as good as the first. That's a really good analogy. So
thank you. I absolutely love this too. And hopefully it won't be another 17 years or whatever it's been since I've been on.
Especially that during all of COVID, we could have easily done it this way that we're doing now.
I feel like people really miss that COVID wasn't like, it didn't put a stop to things because you couldn't actually do them. But like, I just could not bring myself to do some things. Yeah, like, I don't know what it was, but I like COVID has felt like doing putty some days. So
yeah, it absolutely does. I agree. All right. Thanks, everybody, for listening to episode 179. Thanks again to Mason for joining me. I'm the Brant, and until next time, I hope you step into the portal. Bye, everybody.
Boy.